You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastion.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
I've always dreamed of winning a national, but I never knew if it was going to happen. And I never knew it was going to happen when I was 20 years old. I had no idea. And I always knew that Ike was an incredible dog, but I didn't know if you're going to be given the opportunity to show off to that level. So it was the emotions of everything came down in that one moment. And that's what made it so special.
So I'm just getting ready to fly out to Dallas tomorrow morning to work with my team at Purina for the next couple days. And Burke is going to help me with my ad reads, aren't you, tonight?
Yep.
You are. You're a rock star. So, Burke, what can you tell us about Purina Pro Plan?
Purina Pro Plan is like the best thing for your dogs. Because Purina Pro Plan, without it, your dogs couldn't be strong enough to climb mountains and be just strong, really strong. They've got to have Purina Pro Plan because Purina Pro Plan is like the best thing you could find.
The best food to fuel your dog?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant.
Is that what you feed your dogs?
Yeah.
Which Purina formula do you feed Merritt?
Merritt is fed Sport 30-20 chicken and rice.
Good job.
I think.
Yeah, you said that with a question, but you're exactly right. It's a sport formula. It has 30% protein.
Wait, it is?
It is. Oh. It has 30% protein and 20% fat.
Oh.
That keeps them rolling on those mountains that you mentioned. Now let's talk about Boss Shot Shells. What can you tell me about Boss Shot Shells?
Boss Shot Shells, if you swallow a piece, don't worry about it because it won't, because it's non-lead. It could, if something swallowed it, it literally won't get it hurt because it's non-lead. It won't kill anything.
You're right, buddy. Because lead is toxic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Boss is copper-plated bismuth. You know what that means?
No.
That it really packs a punch.
Oh.
So, like, when Dad went out hunting this last week, you know, those new shells we just got in, those are Boss 5s.
Ooh.
What three bird species did Dad all bring back home?
A duck, a pheasant, and it's a...
sharp-tailed grouse.
Oh, it's a sharp-tail?
It is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he was able to shoot all of those. And a lot of the time, if you're not shooting non-tox, then you're not able to go between land and water. But because he was shooting Boss shot shells, he could carry the same shot shell with him through both of those areas.
Okay.
Pretty cool, right?
Yeah, and I know if you don't use Boss shotgun shells and just lead ones, it could, if you were shooting a duck, the lead might drop into the water and a fish might eat it and that might kill the fish and talk, and then it will start spreading bad stuff around the pond and something might get into it or it might kill a whole bunch of stuff.
You're right, bud. Lead is never good, right?
Never good.
It is just
even
never
though
good.
We used to use it, now we know Boss shotgun shells is the best thing for it.
Shoot Boss.
Shoot Boss shotgun shells.
Find out more at bossshotshells.com.
Okay.
What about Onyx? They're our newest sponsor. Do you want to tell our listeners about Onyx? What do you know about Onyx Maps?
I know that Onyx Maps, if you really like a place, you can map it on Onyx. So you know where you can go. And there's like these, like, you can use like color things and there's like these signs where you can use so you know that's there. Right?
What do you, like where we find the birds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In places we think are good, mm-hmm. We can check there too.
Yep, we've checked those out. And that's how we know where to go next time, right?
Yeah.
If we got into, I don't know, like a covey of sharp-tail.
Sharp-tail or rough grouse, mm-hmm. Blue grouse, anything.
Yep, then we know to go there next time. Or if it just looks like good habitat.
Yeah, if you kind of think it's a good habitat, you might want to look around for tough shelter, water, and a food source like snowberries or grouseberries.
What are grouseberries?
Grouseberries are rose hips.
Okay.
These are like these little red berries.
You're right. I'll call them grouseberries. I'm cool with that.
Yeah, we've been going with grouseberries.
That's definitely where we find grouse.
Yep.
They're eating those red berries, aren't they?
Yeah, but we usually... Snowberries are mostly a good snack for birds. That's why you should mostly check for these three things. Tough shelter, water, and snowberries.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
The snowberries are poisonous to us, but to birds, lots of things what we can't eat are their favorite snacks.
Mm-hmm. And if people want to find out more about Onyx Maps, they can go to...
Check out onyxmaps.com.
Good job. All right. And siren shotguns. What can you tell me about siren shotguns?
Siren shotguns are like... They're a good thing for women because they're... My mom has one and she's... There's like... It comes with cases, hats, and only... And shirts and sweatshirts, a whole bunch of stuff. And it's a really good shoot for women. It's the right size, doesn't have much of a kick. And even though it's short, it still has not much of a kick. And yeah, that's all I know.
And it shoots the birds, doesn't it?
It shoots the birds so you can get a lunch on the table.
It fits women right out of the box.
Yep.
You don't even have to have it sized.
Yeah, it will just fit you right away.
Mm-hmm. So if people want to find out more about Siren, where should they go?
SirenUSA.com.
Mm-hmm. Dakota 283, tell me about those awesome dog kennels that we have.
In the car, you can put them in there. So, like, if you have a car accident, it'll keep your dog safe and it locks too. So your dog if it busts its doors open on normal kennels, try these kennels because they lock too. You can lock them so your dog can't get out.
You're right, buddy. That's a really good point. That is actually one of my favorite things about the Dakota 283 kennels. Because you know how we like to go into the gas stations to get snacks and go potty.
Yep.
So then we have to leave the dogs out in the kennels.
And that holds them in.
Yep, and we know that they're safe because we're able to lock the doors, right?
Yeah, no one can get in.
And no one can steal our dogs?
Yep. So that's why it keeps them so safe. So you don't have to worry about your dogs if you have these kennels.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are so good at it.
You're right. And you weren't here for this, but last week on Patreon. So Patreon is where people can go. They pay $5 a month to support the Bird Dog Babe podcast.
Oh.
And last week, because, you know, we like to do fun perks and stuff and giveaways. So last week on Patreon, we had Katie Willis on. Huh. Remember the girl that brought her bird in, the crop in, so that you and Blair could dissect it? Yep.
Yeah.
So she came on, and then we had Emily Spolier on.
Hmm.
You haven't met her, but they both taught all the Patreon members about different ways that they pluck their birds.
I know one way.
What way?
That Hannah does.
What?
So she puts the wings down, steps on the wings, takes the feet, and starts to rip them.
Yeah.
Rip them up, and then that takes the wings right off.
Yeah, so that's an easy way to skin the birds.
Yep.
But this is a way to pluck them, so...
Yeah, you can, like... I like to just... You can take a handful and, like, pluck it out, but little feathers, if you see any talented feathers that you think look, you want to make in earrings, as my mom does, you can, like, pluck them out and put them in a bag and then label that as, like, what bird it is, so you know what it's made out of. Snipe, you can actually always know because of, the stripes on its feathers. white and black. Mm-hmm. It's really cool.
You're right.
Long beak.
What kind of feather project did we use those feathers with this last week?
Oh, we made, like, little ornaments, like...
Christmas ornaments?
Yeah, we made Christmas ornaments, but we didn't paint any, like, ornaments. They're, like, ornaments where you can take the top off. In the middle is empty. We stuffed bird feathers inside them, mm-hmm. and then put our dog's name with, like, the hunt that bird on him.
You're right.
For our bird dog, our mini bird dog tree over here.
We sure did. We should post that little video, shouldn't we, so that people can see how they can do similar to make ornaments for their dogs and their favorite bird feathers that they may have plucked, right?
Yeah.
Because we don't like anything of our birds to go to waste, so we try to use everything possible that we can, including all those duck feet.
He has like little flippers, like dun 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 dun.
My guest today is Jaylee Schwartz. Jaylee is the owner of Green Gable Gun Dogs and winner of the 2021 U.S. Open Cocker National Championship. She has been training and competing with Spaniels since she was 8 years old, alongside her father, Jeff Schwartz, a professional trainer at Rock River Kennels. Jaylee placed in her first licensed AKC Springer trial at 10 years old, and now a professional trainer herself, is the youngest person to win the Open National Cocker Championship. Despite all of Jaylee's accomplishments, she claims failing was a big part of her journey. She believes anything is possible with hard work and dedication. All right, let's get after it. Hey, Jaylee, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So where are you coming to us from?
I'm from my hometown in Beaver Dam, Wisconsin.
Awesome. Crazy story. So I don't know if you knew this, but I grew up in Mayville, Wisconsin.
That's only about 10 minutes from me.
It is. And I've actually sold a lot of houses in Beaver Dam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I did real estate for 15 years while I was there out of our Horicon office. So small world.
That's for sure. It's a beautiful area.
It is. Absolutely. And I think I even recognized your dad's name and kennel name. How long has your dad been training there?
A little over 35 years now.
Okay.
So, and he's always been in Horicon and Beaver Dam.
There's a lot of marsh area around there for that training, for sure.
Yes. The Horicon Marsh, it's very popular around here.
Is that where you guys go pretty often?
Yep. We do quite a bit of duck hunting by the Horicon Marsh. And there are some public land there, too, that we take the dogs out. And we try to find some roosters sometimes in the fall when we have time.
Yeah. Awesome. I know that area very well. So you're just coming off of the 2021 Cocker National, right?
Yes. Yep.
When were the dates of that?
I believe it started November 3rd, and it was 4 days long.
And where was it held this year?
Out in New Jersey. Okay. So it was a little drive. I had never been to New Jersey before, so I was interested to see the scenery, and it was absolutely gorgeous.
Especially that time of year. I'm sure you went through all the fall colors.
Yeah, the colors were just at their peak out there. So mm-hmm. we got a lot of really beautiful pictures. The photographer did a great job out there.
How many nationals have you attended personally?
I've attended quite a few nationals, but this was only my second one that I competed in.
Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 20.
That is incredible. Afterwards, when you go to celebrate, you don't even get to have a drink then, huh?
Yep, exactly.
So you just won. It's the Open National, right?
Yep. It's the 2021 U.S. Open Cocker National Championship.
How many dogs were there?
There were 85 dogs running.
Wow. Is that typically what the numbers are?
Normally there's a few more dogs, but they changed the qualification this year. To only a one-year qualification. So that reduced the number of dogs a little bit. And also because it was held out east, that reduced the number too, just because of the traveling time for a lot of the people around the country.
Sure. And was it held in North Dakota last year?
Yep.
Is that
yep.
right? Okay.
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit about your dog that you won the national championship with.
Yeah, he's a dog named Ike. He's a dog that I personally own. He's 4 years old, so I've had him since he was 8 weeks old. He's kind of always been my buddy. A lot of people kind of have given me a lot of crap with him for the last couple years because they always call him the golden child because they always say he can do no wrong. And I'm like, that's not true. I train him. I correct him. Don't worry. But he's always just been such a special dog to me. And I guess ever since he was just a young puppy, I've saw so much potential in him. It's pretty exciting that 4 years later, I won the national with him.
That's incredible. Is he from your breeding, your stud dog, or anything related to your dogs?
Yeah, so he is the grandson of my original Cocker, Gable. He goes right back to my very first Cocker. I think it makes that national win just so much more special for me, too. I got Gable when I was, I think, 11 years old.
Did you trial Gable as well at 11 years old?
I did run her in a couple field trials. I put a master hunting title on her. And then I placed her, I think I was either 12 or 13 when I placed her in a couple all-age field trials as well. I never was able to put a field champion or amateur field champion title on her just because I was so young and I wasn't really pursuing it, like trialing every single weekend, but I still was able to place her in quite a few trials.
You grew up trialing and hunt testing, right?
Yep.
Hunt testing as well. Did your dad do that?
Yep.
Okay.
My dad actually currently has the most AKC Spaniel Master Hunters out of anyone in the country. He's got, I don't know the exact number, but it's like over 120 of them now. So wow. He's got more than anyone with the Spaniels. That's kind of what I started doing originally when I was about 8 years old. I started running a few hunt tests with my Springer Jimbo. So that's where I got my start. When I was 10, I started running some of the Springer field trials, and I was able to place in a Springer trial when I was 10 years old.
You guys started out with Springer Spaniels.
Yeah. So my dad trains mostly Springers. When I got Gable quite a few years ago now, he was training probably 90% Springers. Since I got Gable and we've really gotten going more with the Cockers, it's about 50-50. But I'm definitely the Cocker girl. I love my Cockers. So that's mostly what I do.
What are some of the tendencies that you prefer with a Cocker over a Springer?
So that's a question I get a lot. I think everybody is different in like what they see in the Springers and the Cockers. I like the Cockers because they're just so personable. They just have a different personality than a Springer does. I think the Cockers are actually a little more quirky. You just kind of have to accept their personality. A Springer is much more businesslike, where a Cocker just has these really quirky personalities that you just kind of have to accept. You know, sometimes they're a little more bouncy. They're always jumping on you. I have most of my Cockers that I actually have taught them all how to jump up in my arms. And then you could be at a field trial or out training and you tell them to jump up, they're going to jump in your arms and then they put their face right by your face and just love on you. Like they just always have that personality where they want to be around you. I guess if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And I have a 6 month old, my very first field bred Cocker. So
yeah.
It's been kind of a fun trying to figure her out, but also trying to sort out, like, I wonder if this is what the breed is like in general, or if she's just super goofy. And I call her like just this little rocket.
Yep.
You know, are they usually like 100 miles per hour at everything they do?
Pretty much. Yep. They're always, a lot of people call them pocket rockets because they're that small package of this just insane amount of energy and drive, you know, little dog, big package. They don't know they're little. They will bust through all the cover that a big dog can. They will go jump in the water and retrieve those ducks for you. They do not know they're small.
Have you ever seen them struggle with a retrieve with ducks or any waterfowl?
I wouldn't say so. It's definitely a bigger bird, so they're going to struggle a little bit, but so do the Springers or the Labradors when they get a big bird. they're dragging it back. And the cockers drag those birds back just as fast, and they try just as hard.
They're a lot, aren't they?
That's for sure.
So you grew up, your dad raised and he bred Springers, right?
Yep.
Okay. So you were kind of doing all the puppy raising with that as well?
Yeah, that's where I originally fell in love with the dogs, was the puppies when I was just really young. I was always, you know, in the puppy pen playing with the puppies. I was, you know, always taking the puppies on little walks, you know, I was just a little fart, and I would have like 8 puppies walking behind me, and I would take them through the grass. I mean, that's where I fell in love with them. And I still love raising puppies and raising litters.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have 3 brothers. I have an older brother and 2 younger brothers.
Have they always been involved with the dogs growing up as well?
They've always had some type of involvement. All 3 of my brothers have run some hunt tests. They're all really big into hunting. They love to hunt. So they're more of the hunters of the family. I'm more the dog handler. My younger 2 brothers in particular are really into the hunting right now. Every chance they can get, they're out there. So.
And are they hunting with Springers or Cockers?
My 16-year-old younger brother has a Cocker. His name is Clay, and that's the dog that my dad actually got a certificate of merit with at the Cocker National. And then Jed, my other youngest one, he's 11. He's kind of adopted 2 of my Cockers. So he is always playing with them.
You had mentioned that you were homeschooled your whole life, right?
Correct. Yep.
So that allowed you to kind of go around and do a lot of the dog things and not have that conflict of interest with everything going on with the school stuff.
Yeah, it allowed such a flexible schedule for me that I was able to travel on the weekends. I was able to, you know, scoot out of school a little bit and go train, especially if I had a trial coming up on the weekend. My mom would always give me a few minute break and be like, all right, go out and train and be back in a half an hour, you know? So the flexibility that gave me, I think really helped me in the long run.
Did you play any sports, or was doing the dog stuff kind of your extracurricular?
Doing the dogs was pretty much my sport. It really consumed my entire life growing up. I was out, it was school and dogs. That was my life. And it pretty much was that way until I started training professionally.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been training professionally?
This is my 2nd year.
Okay.
So, yep.
Okay. And I saw that you started your own kennel name. I mean, your own business, right?
Yep, I did. It's Green Gable Gun Dogs. I named it after Gable, my first cocker. So that's where the name originally came from. So, and Gable was named after Anna Green Gable's the book. So I had just finished reading that book, and then I got my cocker, and I was like, what am I going to name her? Well, that's a perfect fit.
That's a great, great book. I love that one.
It is.
Growing up with this lifestyle, and in this, I'm just personally curious about this because I have 2 children.
Yep.
Young ones that are kind of, you know, being raised in this lifestyle. And I'm always worried of, are they going to grow up to like it and love it? Or are they going to grow up to resent it?
Right.
You know, having with the amount of work that we put into them, or are they going to take it for granted type of thing?
Mm-hmm.
So what are some of the things you think your parents did or didn't do that really helped kind of support this lifestyle so much that you wanted to do this professionally yourself?
I think it helps. Like my dad, he never pushed me to do it. He never, you know, I feel like a lot of parents, I see it with like sports. They're always pushing their kids. And I just don't think I would have reacted well to that. It was kind of something that I had to decide I wanted to do on my own. And I know there was plenty of times in my life where, you know, I might have been having a hard year or whatever. And I really had to, I went back on the dogs because that's what I love to do. And I feel like if I had somebody pushing me to do that, I wouldn't have loved it so much. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's making me the handler and the trainer that I am today is that love that I have for the dogs. And I don't think I would have had that if somebody was always pushing me to do it. Mm-hmm. It's something that in my head, that was always what I fell back on. You know, if I ever had a bad day, I went straight to the kennel. I wanted to be with my dogs. I want to take my dogs for a run. I just feel like it was something that I had to kind of do on my own. Mm-hmm. And I do know, like, a lot of people will say that a professional's kid does have a really big advantage, especially in the field trials or just in the sport in general. And I do agree with that a lot, just because you have your foot in the door ever since you're young, but you still have to put the work into it and you still have to choose that's what you want to do. And you have to put forth 100%. You have an advantage, but I also feel you still have to put all that work and all that effort and all that emotion into it.
And watching your dad every day do his daily routine, mm-hmm. do you find yourself having a similar routine?
I do. And, you know, sometimes watching him work so, so hard, I think to myself, why am I choosing this career path? Honestly, you know, he works sun up from sundown every single day. And sometimes you look at that and you're like, that's my life now. It gives you such a huge role model to look up to and understand that's what it takes to be successful.
Did your parents ever say, now you need to go train your dog? If you want to do this, you know, today or it's 2:00. This is your time period to go train your dog. Or did you just say, I want to go train my dog?
It was something I always did on my own.
Okay.
I don't remember a time ever in my life where somebody told me I needed to go do it. I think I was just always doing it on my own. And with that being said, I think there might have been a time where I was really busy with school or whatever, that maybe I wasn't spending a huge amount of time with them just because I had so much other stuff going on. But I don't, kind of falling back on, I don't think my dad ever pushed me to do it. Because I really think he just let me kind of find myself on my own.
What are some of the accomplishments that you had as a kid?
There's no official records kept with this, as far as I'm aware, with the AKC, but I'm the youngest person to place in a licensed Springer field trial. So I did that at 10 years old. And then when I was 15 years old, I handled the number 2 amateur all-age dog in the country. And I only ran 5 trials with that dog. Wow. And I got 3 wins and 2 seconds. So it was pretty incredible year, because I really didn't run that many trials, but yet I was still able to make it so far to the top just because of how consistent that dog was. Last year was a really exciting year with Ike. I put a field champion title on him. And then he was just running really consistent for me. We made it to number 2 in the country again last year. So close to number 1 many times. But little did I know our time was coming this year. But then of course this year I was able to win the national championship. And then a lot in those years, I think I titled close to 15 dogs in the hunt tests.
Wow.
And I have 8 master hunters.
That's incredible. Do you think your year-end standings, I'm assuming after 85 dogs at the national, that's going to probably put you...
Are you saying with like the high points this year?
Yeah. So, will that help in with ending, you know, number 1?
The points are more like regional. So like regionally, I was number 2 again by 1 point this year in our region. So that's like what, the 3rd time that's happened to me. But I'm always right there. So, but the national points don't count towards that, because it was outside of our region.
You're looking for the regional.
Yep.
Regional points. Okay.
Yeah. They also have like United States high point dog, but generally it's harder to get those when you're running in the Midwest, because our trials are really big here. Mm-hmm. So it's usually a harder thing to do.
Yeah. And when you're campaigning to be a top running dog, you're just staying in your own region then, right?
Yeah, most of the time. So with being in Wisconsin, It's actually a really big advantage because we have so many trials right here versus people that live in like North Dakota or those kind of states where they're traveling, you know, 10, 12 hours to get to their local trial. Where by my place here, I mean, half of our trials, we don't even have to stay overnight. We can drive back and forth from our house. So we pretty much go all fall to our local trials and never leave the Midwest. We're in Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois.
Will you train year round in Wisconsin as well, or do you travel?
Most of the time I train year round in Wisconsin.
What about your dad? Does he stay in Wisconsin as well?
Yep. He stays in Wisconsin other than they take about 6 or 8 weeks off and they go down south on vacation.
Oh, nice.
Yep. And they leave the whole kennel to me.
Oh, perfect.
Yep.
So how many dogs will you take in at a time now that you're training?
I try to only take around 8 to 10 clients dogs at a time for myself personally, because that's about all that I can handle as of right now. But with that being said, I own like 13 dogs that most of them are in training at some level. And then also between the three trainers that work out of our kennel, we have close to 50 dogs there at a given time. And one of my biggest jobs is taking care of the kennels.
Do you guys train spaniels only, or do you do any retrievers and pointers?
We train mostly spaniels and some retrievers.
When you say like the Wisconsin region, I know several spaniel people there because Jordan Horak's there.
Yep.
Jason at Lighthouse Kennel.
Yep. Jason, right? Gibbons.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have some pretty tough competitors right there in your backyard with you guys.
Yeah, there's a lot of competition in this area, but it just makes you work harder.
Right. So. Would you say like the Wisconsin region is one of the toughest?
They normally say the Midwest is the most competitive region for springers and cockers. I would say that's mostly because we have a lot of professionals in the small area. Mm-hmm. So on a given weekend, you're always competing against 3 or 4 pros. Okay. Where if you go to different regions, the pros are a little bit more spread out. So you might only be competing with 1 or 2.
How many personal dogs do you have in the house with you?
I usually only have about 2 or 3 of them in the house at a time. Yeah. But they all get rotated in because that's part of my breeding program, is I want to make sure my dogs have a good on and off switch. Mm-hmm. So if they come in the house, they need to be able to calm down and lay on their bed and just be a good house dog. Otherwise, I don't want to reproduce them, because I know that 95% of these puppies that I'm selling are going to be house dogs. And most of the time you spend with your dog is in the house. So right. I want to make sure that's a quality that they have.
And it's such a high caliber breed, right? So yes. I mean, they're already a lot of dog. At what age do they start slowing down? Inquiring minds want to know.
The dog. You know, it all depends on the dog. What I do a lot with my cockers is I teach them all about the place board. So when I first bring them in the house, I immediately teach them how to sit and stay on their place board in the house. So it kind of teaches them right off the bat. Like, coming in the house doesn't mean you get to run around and be crazy. It means you need to have that calm mindset. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they don't get to run around and play, but they have to have that mindset that, you know what, this isn't all fun and games. I have to learn how to control myself too.
What is your favorite aspect of training?
I think the best thing about it is just having that relationship with the dog. That's what I'm always striving for. And I think it's so special too, because you don't always get that with every single dog. Mm-hmm. I'm always working towards having that relationship, but sometimes it doesn't ever come. That's why it's so special when you have it. And yeah. that's one of the things I have with Ike, is just this super strong relationship and bond. It's kind of crazy. I trust him as much as he trusts me. It's something I've never experienced before. And that's one of the things that most every judge that judges us will say, the trust.
And when you get other people's dogs in for training, what are some of the things that you do right off the bat to work on getting that trust and that relationship with them?
I do a lot of work on the place boards. So I kind of, right away when I get a dog in, I make the place board a really good spot. And I also give them a lot of treats on there just so that they are kind of established, or they're associating the board and me with positive reinforcement with the treats. And then after that, I think it's all just the time that you spend with them. Every minute and every hour that you spend with the dogs, they're going to start gaining a relationship with you. And the more time you do, the more time you spend with them, the more they're going to begin to trust you.
With the place board work, are you always making them sit on there, or do you ask them to stand, lay down? Are there different commands, or is it always consistent with every time you hit that board, this is what you're doing?
Pretty much every time they're on there, they just sit. And okay. Sometimes, depending on what I'm doing, they don't even have to sit. It's just going to that spot.
What is your release for them? Do you use their name? Do you use a command?
I use the word okay or their name. I work a lot of dogs, multiple dogs at once. So all my dogs know that their name is always at their release as well, just because I can't have a general word for their release all the time when right. I have four or five of them sitting in front of me and I only want one of them to go.
Yeah.
So, and I think I do a lot of that kind of work too, to build trust. I work with multiple dogs at once so that they learn to trust me. It's all the time that you spend with them. That's the biggest thing I can say. Like with Ike, I spend so much time with him just in the house. You know, I work a lot with like little cheese balls, the cheese puffs.
Yeah.
Cause they roll across the hardwood floor. So yeah. I do all of my steadiness drills with my puppies and with him right on the hardwood floor in the kitchen. And all that little stuff adds up.
So explain that drill, if you don't mind. Explain like yep. kind of what you're doing with the cheese balls. You're rolling it while you have them on a place board?
Yeah, that's usually how I start. I like to start teaching steadiness with a cheese ball versus like a tennis ball or a bird, just because when they're starting to understand the concept, I don't want them to take anything negative out on a bird or the tennis ball. So I like to teach the concepts with a cheese ball, something that they really like, but it's not going to hurt them if they get confused. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of, when I first start, I just have them sitting on the board and I roll the cheese ball across the floor. And then I have it where I roll the cheese ball right past them. And I'm always using the whistle for their sit command. Mm. So, the more stuff you do with that in the house, the easier it's going to transfer out in the field and the less confused that they can possibly get, because they have all this foundation training.
Right. And I think I saw a picture maybe on your website where you had a puppy with a paint roller in its mouth.
Yep.
Is that what you use for some of your drills too?
I do. I like using paint rollers because they're really light and soft. So they love them. Mm-hmm. But I teach all the puppies how to retrieve those. And that's the first thing that I use when I teach the dogs how to hold something, just because they're so light and fluffy and they want to have them in their mouth. So I rather train kind of more positively than, so if they want to have that in their mouth, that's what we're going to use.
Do you eventually do any e-collar work with them?
I generally collar condition all the dogs that I have, but I don't always use the collar. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I have the collar on all the dogs when I train them, but I don't ever use it. It's just something I have to fall back on if I want to. I don't mind using them if the dogs are fully conditioned and they fully understand what they're doing and they fully understand when they're doing something wrong, that's why they're getting the collar pressure.
Let's talk about some of the obstacles that you've had. I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of people, just the young age in general is an obstacle. You're going against yep. some really seasoned pros. And while you kind of had, you know, you had a jump start, that mm-hmm. not many kids are fortunate to grow up in that lifestyle, but still coming from that background doesn't necessarily give you an advantage.
Right. It's one of those things, like with growing up in it, I've never really thought of it as a disadvantage. I've never I've just never really went to a trial and been like, wow, I got to compete against all these pros. I think that's just because I grew up in it. And all these other pros, they're basically my friends. I've grown up with them, you know? They're kind of like my aunts and uncles, you know? Like, so I've never really been that, like, nervous to run against them. I feel like it could come across that way. But just because I grew up in it, it doesn't feel like it.
What are some of the other things you've had to overcome?
Yeah, so I've actually had migraines, chronic migraines, for 8 years now. So that's definitely something that has really made my life difficult and made it difficult to train and be able to get through school and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's pretty debilitating for a long time. I'm finally at the point where I'm on the right medicine now that I am able to pretty much function normally. Yesterday, I had a migraine for the first time in quite a few weeks. I didn't have a migraine at all when I was out in New Jersey, which I couldn't believe it. I was so thankful for that because it does affect the way you think, and it does affect it feels like it slows your whole body down. Like mm-hmm. when I have a migraine, it's like, okay, you got to do this. What it takes 5 seconds for my body to react to it. It's just kind of, it slows everything down. That's the way I feel. But it's kind of been a lifestyle of mine for so many years. I just learned how to push through it. Wow. And
I can't relate personally, but I have friends that struggle with it. And I mean, is it not a thing where you have it almost all day long, or you have to sit quietly in a dark room and all that stuff?
Yeah. And my migraines that I had were one, like when I had them really bad for mm-hmm. a few years, they never left. I had this constant pain in my head every single day. I woke up with it. I went to bed with it. It's just the way it was. Wow. And it's funny because I didn't realize how bad it was until I got the right help. Because like looking back now, I'm like, how did I even live like that? How did I even, you know, get up and train every day or get up and go to school? How did I do that? Because now my mind is clear. And it's crazy that I was even able to function like that.
And just this year, was it right before your national that you struggled with COVID, right?
Yeah. So I actually it was my 1 year anniversary of having COVID yesterday on Thanksgiving. Wow. So last year, around Thanksgiving time is when I originally got COVID, and I didn't think it was going to be that bad. You know, it was like, all right, sick for a couple weeks, I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, it turned out to be a lot worse than that. I was sick for 4.5 months, like sick enough that I couldn't train. I pretty much couldn't do anything outside because I couldn't be out in the cold. So it actually affected my liver. So I was in the hospital for quite a little bit of time as well. And I was in and out. I was going to the urgent care a lot to get the fluid IVs and everything because I was just so dehydrated. Mm-hmm. About a month after I started feeling better this spring, I actually, you know, I started training again. So it's about a month I started training, and I actually went to a field trial with Ike, and I won back-to-back opens with them. And it was just so crazy because I was like, I can't believe a month ago I could hardly do anything. It's crazy how fast your body can bounce back after being so sick. But I will say that this entire summer, I haven't felt normal. Like my body was just so weak from being sick. So it was something that I just, you know, it's kind of hard to believe that I was able to be so sick and not feel 100% and still give it my all. And mm-hmm. I gave it his all, and we were able to have the most incredible year.
Wow. Did you get to compete with him last year?
I did. I competed. Okay. So I'm trying to think how this all played out, but I think last year, my dad ran him the first weekend of the fall trials, and he placed him once, and then I took over, and since then, I've been the only one running him. So my dad and I kind of tag-teamed Ike together. Yeah. I trained him for the most part up until about a year old, and then my dad took him for a couple months and ran him in his first trial, his first all-age trial. And he actually won his very first all-age trial we ever put him in. So, which is pretty unlikely to happen.
And that was at a year old?
He was 2 at the time.
Okay.
So I had him for the first year and a half. My dad took him for a couple months, ran him, won his first trial with him. Then it was like the end of the year. I'm trying to think how this all played out. It was 2 years ago. It's hard for me to remember all the details now. But needless to say, my dad got the first win on him. And it actually turned out to be so special because I was able to get a second win to make him a field champion. Mm-hmm. So we did that together.
You have a very close bond with Ike.
Yes.
Do you notice a difference with Ike and your dad than with you and him?
Well, Ike is a dog that will run for anyone because he loves his job. And he's very well trained, so he will run for anyone, and he should behave for anyone. Should. But I do think that Ike and I do have a very special bond just because of all the time that we've spent together. Mm-hmm. But he's also an extremely talented dog, so it doesn't really matter who runs him. That's still going to show off.
What are some of the characteristics that you saw in Ike as a youngster that you were like, yeah, I think he's special. I think I really need to focus in and hone the skills of this dog.
Well, as a puppy, he was just so bonded to me. You know, he would never stop looking at me. He would follow me everywhere. He would fall asleep in my arms at every chance he would get. I was just talking to my dad about it this morning. I'm like, do you remember Ike hardly ever walked around when he was a puppy? Because I just carried him everywhere. He was just so content with being around you. So that's kind of the first thing that I loved about him. And it wasn't even that I saw like, oh, you're going to be a national field champion because you love me. It was just that I loved him so much because of that bond he gave to me. But as we started training him, he showed a really incredible nose. He showed this incredible drive. You know, that sometimes the Cockers lack a little bit is a really strong flush, a really hard driving dog. Sometimes they don't always have that. So that's what caught my eye. And then also his style. You could just tell when he was young, the way he moved his tail, the way he ran, that it was just so eye appealing. You just wanted to watch him. And that's kind of what it takes to be a trial dog. You have to catch the judge's eye.
If you could explain a little bit for listeners of what goes on at the national. Well, first of all, what's required to get there?
Yeah, so in order to qualify for the national, you first have to place at one of the local trials. So you have to place there and then you get invited to the national. So the local trials, they consist of 3 series, which are kind of run similar to the national, but there's just 3 series at a local trial, where the national has 5 series. So it's much more intense, and you have to be on your A game for almost twice as many series. So that's kind of what sets the two apart.
So what happens in the first series?
The first and second series and the third and fourth series at the national are held in braces. So they're running 2 dogs at once because there's 2 judges. But after each series, there's an elimination. So you have to get called back to each series. So there started off with 85 dogs, and only 16 of them made it back to the 5th series, which is the final round.
Okay.
So after each series, there's an elimination, and the judges get together and decide which dogs that they liked.
Okay. What is required of them work-wise in the first series?
Yeah, so they held the first series in what they called an overgrown horse pasture. So it was kind of a grasses, mixed grasses. So depending on the dog and depending on what circumstances they were put in, they either got 2 or 3 contacts, so 2 or 3 birds they were required to find. So they had to run the wind properly, find their birds. Once they found the bird, they have to flush it and be steady, which, you know, so they have to sit to the flush. And then depending where the bird fell and if it was hit, then they're sent on the retrieve. So they need at least 2 contacts, but depending on what happened, they might have gotten 3. And then the second series was held in that same spot so that the other judge could watch the dog in there too. So if your dog did good, it would get called back to the second series under the other judge. in that horse pasture.
Okay. And then you do the same work for the second series then, just under a different judge?
Correct.
Okay. What is the third series?
So for the third series, and they ran the third and the fourth series in the same course, that they moved into the woods. And each part of the course was a little bit different. In my third series, I ran in some really, really thick bramble type cover. It was hard enough, I could hardly walk through it. It was like knee high thistles and brambles. But each part of the course was a little bit different. Like in my fourth series, I was in a little bit more open cover in the woods. So it was a little bit easier, at least for me to walk through.
Yeah. So in the third series, did you have both judges watching that?
No, the third and the fourth are also run in braces.
Same. Okay.
So, yep. Not until the fifth series are both the judges watching. Okay. And it's just run as a single.
And then what happens in the fifth series then as a single?
Yeah. So in the fifth series, both the judges would walk behind you and there wouldn't be a brace mate. So there's only one dog running. And in the fifth series, every dog, I think, got at least three birds, if not more. It just all depended what the judges wanted to see.
Is there any water work required at the national?
Yep. So the very last step of the national is just one simple watermark. Pretty much it was just to make sure the dog would go in the water and get it, get the bird. So it's not as huge of a deal as like in the hunt test where there's a lot more emphasis put on the water work. It was more just a simple watermark. They have to be steady by your side. And then when the judge taps you, you get to release them. They go get the bird and bring it back.
How many finished out the fifth series that judges were able to kind of get together then and decide out of how many of those dogs are still in consideration?
Yeah. So I believe it was 16 dogs made it to the fifth series. And only 12 dogs made it through there. The fifth series was actually very difficult. Generally, when you get to the fifth series, the dogs pretty much are all going to make it through just because they've proven themselves to get there. They've proven that they're very consistent in the first series, the second series, the third series, and the fourth series. So by the time they get to the fifth series, these are the cream of the crop dogs. There was just a lot. It was a very difficult fifth series. The cover was very difficult. So only 12 dogs made it out of the fifth that went to the water.
What do you think Ike had that made him the standout?
I think it was a combination of how consistent he was. On our second series, we had a really big runner. So he got on this bird and he had to trail it out. I'm not good with the amount of yards, but it was probably 50 or 60 yards through all this horse pasture with all this grass that was kind of laid over. And it was unique only because there wasn't that many runners that day. Most of the dogs weren't getting runners. So for him to come up there and just make it look so beautiful made him stand out. You know, he nailed all of his marks, the whole national. He never mismarked one of them. He had beautiful finds on all of his birds. He ran a really nice pattern. In the fourth series, we got put into this woods part that was a little bit more open, like I said. And he actually found four birds and a flag and a half, which is about three times more birds than they're supposed to find in that short period of time because there were so many birds in there. And he just blew them all out and looked really good doing it. So wow. He was given the opportunity to really stand out there too.
Overachiever.
Yeah. that could have made us look really bad or really good. So I'm thankful for him and his nose. He made it look good.
Yeah. What kind of birds are used at the National?
So the first and second series were on pheasants. And then the third and fourth series were on chuckers, but there were pheasants in the woods just running around. So they may have found some of those too. And then the fifth series, I found all pheasants in there, but there was just a mix of birds, you know, so there were some people even finding bobwhite in there, which weren't planted birds. They were just happened to be in the course because it was kind of like a game farm where it was held. So there was just a mix of birds everywhere.
Wow. That's amazing. And the dogs are expected to work all birds the same regardless.
Pretty much. Yeah. So the bobwhite in the fifth series, they didn't shoot those just because they weren't planted birds, but if they happened to be on the course, you were expected to find them.
What happens if they miss a bird shooting it?
The judge may ask you to go find another one if they want to see a retrieve, but it's really no fault of you or the dog if the bird is missed, but you're still expected to be able to call the dog right back off of it. So a lot of dogs, when you miss a bird, they're going to still want to go see if you hit it, right? So they're expected to just leave that and forget about it. So, but then just depending on what the judges have seen before, they may want to see another bird to get a retrieve, or they may excuse you.
At any point, do you have to do blind retrieves?
So it's not a required thing in the field trials, but in my fourth series at the National, one of Ike's birds that he found, he was really dug into a bramble bush to flush one of his chuckers. So he never saw the bird shot or where it fell. So he did a blind retrieve in the fourth series for that. So it's not an expected thing, but if you get put in a situation, your dog's expected to be able to come up with that bird.
Do you think you get like maybe some bonus points for that?
I think so. He okay. nailed it.
That's so cool.
It was one of those things where you couldn't have walked the bird out there and set it there and him taking a better line. So I'm not going to lie. I was pretty impressed. I was like, all right, that worked out. Because sometimes that can be a bad thing. And, you know, and other times you can make it look really good.
Tell me about that moment of what happened after when that fifth series was done. Did they have everybody come gather? What did you guys have to do there?
Yeah, so we all caravaned back to this tent that we had this little kind of party in. They had caterers come and they had some really great food and everyone was just kind of hanging out. I will say I was a little bit too nervous to eat much, but I heard the food was really good. You know, coming off of the water series, I knew I had a really good trial. I really couldn't say that I was winning it. You know, I knew that everything we did was spot on. That whole trial was just, you know, picture perfect, everything I could have asked for. But you don't know what the other dogs did too. You don't know what kind of opportunities they were given.
Right.
So, you know, when they started the awards ceremony, you know, they give every dog that completed the National a certificate of completion. So I was able to go up there and get that. And, you know, at that point I was thrilled. I was happy. You know, I made it through the National. That's all I could have really asked for. And, then they gave the certificate of merits out. They gave 4 certificate of merits out. My dad and Clay got a certificate of merit, which is just a really special accomplishment. Certificate of merit pretty much means that you were considered for placement, but you didn't, you know, you just weren't quite there, but you were so close, you know, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
was your dad feeling
thing.
Pretty good about it too with his play?
You know, yeah. He was saying, you know, this was one of the best trials he's ever had.
Wow.
You know, he did really, really good. And I'm just sitting there like, I know I did good, but I don't know like how, you know, cause you don't see every dog. I didn't see his run. So like, I'm like, well, maybe you are beating me. I'm not sure.
And how many other trials have you been to before too, where you're like, I had a great day. My dog had a perfect day. And then you don't end up being that winner of the day.
Yeah. So, and it does happen. A lot of times, like you can kind of tell by the way the judges are reacting that they really like your dog. You can just see it in their face. You know, but I've been fooled a couple times at local trials where I was like, I had it one time this fall where I was like, I thought I was having the most incredible trial and I didn't win. And I couldn't, like in my head, I couldn't believe it because I was like, I couldn't have asked for anything better. But then I was also like, you know what? That dog that won must have had an absolutely incredible day, you know, to have beat me because I thought I did so great, you know? So you kind of have to look at it that way. But needless to say, you know, they gave the 4 certificate of merits out. And I didn't get one of those. And I was like, you know, I might place, you know, like I couldn't ask for anything more. I might place in this national, you know? And I was like, wow, I think I have a shot at that. So, you know, they called the fourth place out. They called the third place out. And then they called the second place out. And at that point in your head, I was a little bit nervous because I was like, this could be it, or I couldn't get anything, you know, like this is kind of where it's going to all come down to. And I remember right before the judge called my name, he looked right at me and I knew it. I knew it right in that moment because the judge isn't going to look right. They want to see a reaction, you know? So he looked right at me and he called number 53 Ike. And there was just so many emotions that came down in that moment. My dad was definitely crying more than me because he was just so, I mean, it was all of his emotions from the last 35 years of, you know, trying to train a national champion. And then, you know, the last 20 years with me and watching me train dogs and work the puppies and, you know, all that stuff, like all those emotions came down in that one moment. And it was kind of, it was very cool too, because around that table, there was a lot of our friends who were all standing there. And I think most of us were all crying just because it was, you know, it's something that I've always dreamed of winning a national, but I never knew if it was going to happen. And I never knew it was going to happen when I was 20 years old. I had no idea. And I always knew that Ike was an incredible dog, but I didn't know if you're going to be given the opportunity to show off to that level. So it was the emotions of everything came down in that one moment. And that's what made it so special.
Gosh. Yeah. It gives me goosebumps.
Yeah. And I'm almost want to cry talking about it again.
So special. How amazing. It is. Wow. Do you think he's your once in a lifetime dog?
I think, you know, he is definitely a once in a lifetime dog.
Yeah.
But I'm really hoping that I get more like him.
Yeah.
And because of the puppies he's producing, I hope that maybe someday I'll have another one out of one of his, you know, out of his line.
Will you be at the national with him again next year?
Yes, I'll be there. It's in Perfect. Illinois next year, so it's a little closer to home.
Oh, nice. So what are your future plans with Ike now?
Well, I'm going to continue running him. He's only 4 years old, so I think he's got so much, you know, so much time left in him as far as how long I can compete with him. And one of Ike's biggest qualities, now I don't want to like set myself in the corner here, but he is an extremely consistent dog. You know, he doesn't, you know, he's so consistent. He doesn't want to mess up. He's always trying to do what's best for you. So he's one of those dogs that I would love to keep running because he's not on the verge of being crazy or on the verge of having a breaking problem or something like that. So, and he's just a blast to run. So I want to continue running him and having fun with him.
Has he had a stud career yet?
He's had a few litters, but I'm assuming that's going to pick up now.
Yeah, probably.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
He does like the ladies, so it's an advantage for him.
Have you used him at stud yet?
I've used him a couple times. I have a couple puppies out of them, and they're turning out pretty well. So I'm excited to see what he keeps producing and hopefully have some more little nice dogs running around.
Are you finding similar characteristics as far as bonding with you or them being like those reliable, consistent little dogs?
Well, they're all puppies yet. So they're kind of still in a puppy stage. But right now I'm really liking how all of his puppies have a really strong drive. They, you know, they have a really good nose. They have a strong flush when they flush those birds. They have a leaping flush. They're in the air after them. So those are all really good qualities that I look for in my puppies. So he's doing a good job there so far.
Yeah. And I looked at his pedigree briefly. Yeah. Obviously it's foreign to me, but very easy to recognize and appreciate the fact that every single generation is a field champion, national field champion, amateur field champion, everywhere in his pedigree. Yep. It's beautiful. Yep.
Yeah, and that's one of those things too that we always have to look at. You know, a lot of people think they can just get a dog and it's going to be good. I think I'm very big into the pedigrees, and every dog I get, I go straight to the pedigree. I don't even sometimes care if the parents are titled. I go straight back to the pedigree. I'm like, what's behind there? Mm-hmm. So that's something that, like, I strongly encourage people, no matter what breed of dog you're looking at, the pedigree should be of the utmost importance. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be even like what puppy you're picking in that litter. It should always be about what's behind that dog.
And you doing the hunt test as well. Yeah, we haven't really talked too much about mm-hmm. that. Are you doing that 50-50? Are you spending more time doing the field trials?
It kind of depends. You know, the summer is the most popular time for the hunt test, so it's kind of your off season for the field trials.
Okay.
I will say that our clients really, really love the hunt tests because they, you know, the hunt tests really are going to emphasize a hunting dog. So if you can have a master hunter, you're going to have an incredible hunting dog. And most of our clients are strictly hunters or, you know, hunters, and they run hunt tests, you know. So really most of our business is more hunt tests than field trials. You know, field trials only take up a more small percentage of our business.
Do you see a difference in the dogs? Maybe more independence in field trials? Or do you think that the dogs should be able to do both very well interchangeably?
You know, I think a spaniel should be able to do the things that are required in a master hunt test. Just because, you know, the Springers and the Cockers, they're bred for versatility. They're bred for a dog that can, you know, find pheasants. They can retrieve a duck or two. You know, the Springer is supposed to be the most versatile dog, right? So the hunt tests really showcase that, where the field trials are more showing off the styles of the dog, how they run, how they find their birds. So it's kind of only a piece of what the spaniel is. Mm-hmm. But it is the hunting ability, the style, the nose. Those are the most important traits of a spaniel, but the spaniel is still supposed to be a versatile dog, where the hunt tests come in.
With Ike, what came first, the field champion or the master hunter?
The field champion. Kind of what we do with our dogs that we know we want to run the field trials and the hunt tests. We always want to make sure we get the win on them first in the field trials, and then we'll start running them in the hunt test. That's only because the win is usually the hardest thing to get in the field trials, is the win. So if you can get the win out of the way, then you can kind of start focusing more on doing other things.
What about characteristics? So, you know, you were talking about when you're breeding, you look really heavily at the pedigrees.
Yep.
So when you have puppies, at what age are you deciding whether you want a puppy from that litter, or is, when you personally breed, are you always planning on keeping a puppy or two or however from that mm-hmm. litter? Tell me a little bit about how you do it as a breeder.
Yeah. So usually I know by the time the dog is 1 year old, if I'm going to want to keep it in my breeding program, I'm going to be able to see all like the raw qualities of the dog. You know, you're going to be able to see the nose, you know, how good their nose is, how they run, their style, their biddability in the first year of training. So usually within the first year, I'm going to be able to tell if this is a dog that I want to reproduce. That's just kind of my general thing. So then from there, I either keep pursuing training them, or I might consider selling them as a hunting dog, because they'll make incredible, even though they're not going to fit into my breeding program, they're going to make somebody an incredible dog. So then I kind of focus more on training for that. But then at 2 years old, I can finish their health testing. So not until after two are any of my dogs brought into the breeding program. So the first 2 years, it's all about the qualities that I like in them and passing their health testing.
What about as puppies, before you let them go to their new homes? What are you looking for?
Really, with puppies, I'm not a big into puppy picking. I don't care what puppy I get in the litter. Like I said, it's all about the pedigree. I don't really think it's that important which puppy you get out of the litter. I think it's important what you do with the puppy after you get it. You know, a lot of people put so much emphasis on the puppy that they get, where most of the time the last pick of the litter turns out to be the best one, you know?
Right.
It's all about the pedigree and what you're going to do with it once you get the puppy. Mm-hmm. You know, just in general, if I have a litter of, you know, 6 puppies in front of me and I'm going to be keeping one, I usually go for the one that might want to be by me more, or the one that's always looking at me. I love the eye contact. You know, if a puppy can show you eye contact at 8 weeks old, like, that's going to go a long ways. So, you know, I kind of am drawn to them. And sometimes, you know, I'm not into the looks of the dogs. I'm not into the color.
Okay.
But when you have really well-bred puppies in front of you, you know, if you have a puppy that you're drawn to because of the color, then it's no big deal, because you're only caring about the pedigree in the first place. So then if you have one that you like the color, maybe I might grab that one.
Right. And, you know, like in the pointing dog world, where I should say, be more specific, like with German wire hair pointers, mm-hmm. our field trial dogs, a lot of the really serious field trialers want them to be white. Mm-hmm. So you can see them when they're
yep.
you know, far up ahead. Right. And ones that do more waterfowl will want mm-hmm. Maybe solid liver or a black yep. roan. Is that similar in the spaniel world?
It is. You know, a lot of times if I have somebody that's coming to pick a puppy and they're a really avid grouse hunter, I'm like, you know what? You might want the puppy that has more white on it because it's going to be easier to see in the woods. Or, you know, so that's something that I do bring up, but I don't think it's really that important. I will say, like, you know, Ike he's pretty much all white. He's a lot easier to see when he's running through the woods and he catches your eye a little bit better. But a lot of my solid color dogs have been really incredible too. So mm-hmm. I just don't think color is that important to me. I don't breed for it. Sometimes I have a special color that kind of, you know, catches my eye, but it's not something that I don't feel like it's that important.
Mm-hmm. And cockers come in like every single color you could ever imagine.
Yeah. I think over 20 colors. So it's
crazy.
And it's kind of fun to have cocker litters too, because there could be one, every one of them could be a different color. And you just, it's like a box of chocolates. You just never know. It's so cool.
And I mean, I feel like the breed is gaining so much popularity recently. Do you think so?
Yep. It's gaining a lot of popularity, and the cockers have become better too. You know, there's more people getting involved with them. More people are training them. So I think that the breed is getting better. But with that being said, there are a lot of breeders out there that are just breeding for color, or they're not doing the proper health testing because they can get by with it because the dogs are so popular. So, you know, the average buyer might not be even looking for the health testing or whatever. So with that being said, I think the popularity of the cockers, it's a good thing, but also it can be negative as well. So
what are the health clearances that people interested in getting a cocker puppy? What should they be looking for that the parents have?
Yeah, pretty much the common practice is that they'll have their hips done with a OFA. They'll have their eyes certified with the OFA, and they'll have a DNA panel completed.
And you just want to look for normal ratings. Except
yeah.
like, so hips is fair. Okay. And considered okay in your breed.
It is. People can breed them with fair hips, as long as you're breeding them to another dog with like excellent hips. And also I think it's important that the breeders are, doing health guarantees with their puppies too. So I always do that with mine. Just because they have something to fall back on too. And you're just guaranteeing, you're putting forth your full effort into producing the best dogs that you can.
What is the most common health issue with the breed?
You know, I will say that I think we're doing a pretty good job with the health testing. Now in my area, we're producing really high quality dogs with these field trial dogs. So it might be different with some of the cockers that aren't as well bred. So I don't know what issues that they're having. I know that a couple years ago, the AMS was a really big deal. And right off the top of my head, I couldn't even tell you what that is, what those initials are even for right now, like the exact wording of it. But we all started testing for it, and it's really not a big deal anymore just because we all test for it. But I know there was a few dogs with those issues. I couldn't tell you like what's the biggest health issue with them, because we don't really see that many health issues in our breeding up here.
When I went over to England a couple years ago, I hunted with some cockers, and they're like all different sizes and shapes, and like, what's that breed? And they're all cockers. Do you find that in the US here, we have similar variants within the breed?
Yeah. They really do come in all shapes and sizes and colors. Even two puppies from the same litter can look completely different. The average range for cockers anywhere from like 22 to 34 pounds. You know, that's kind of the average range, but you'll have a puppy.
That's quite a range.
With the males and the females, but you'll have like two puppies from the same litter, and one of them will be on the higher end and one will be on the lower end. You just kind of never know what you're going to get.
What is your best advice for someone that is considering giving the Spaniel Field Trials a go?
Well, I think they should, because it is fun. I will say it's a little bit addicting, but my best advice would be, to find a quality dog, and then try to find somebody local that you can train with, whether it's a professional or a local field trial club or hunt test club. That's going to be the best place to start, where you can just get out there, you can watch the dogs, you can meet the people, you can kind of see which direction you want to go.
Where can we find out about those?
Yeah, so if you want to get or look into the field trials, the Cocker field trials, fieldcockers.com would be a really good place to go. That also lists all the field trials in each region. So if you wanted to go watch a field trial, which is a great way to learn and to meet some of the dog people, that's all listed on there. And it's also a really good resource to look at the field cockers.
Are the clubs listed on there as well then?
I believe so, but okay. I would have to double check on that.
What's your favorite piece of gear?
Honestly, I was thinking about that earlier today. And I just feel like with all the different, seasons that Wisconsin has, I don't really have like one thing that's my favorite. Like in the summertime, I'm always wearing the quick dry pants from Duluth because it feels like you're wearing shorts. I love wearing those. I love my Lashamu boots. Those are my favorite boots I'll ever wear. I wear them like slippers because that's what they feel like. They're like wearing tennis shoes or slippers to train in.
I don't have a pair, but I've heard that they're amazing.
They are. Yeah. They're a little bit expensive, but I feel like they're worth it. Mm-hmm. So those are probably my two favorite things.
Okay. What's on your lanyard?
Generally, I like to keep it simple. I usually just have my one Acme whistle, 2 10.5. But I always have a couple spare whistles. I have a couple in the truck. I've got a couple extra in the kennel because you never know when you're going to need one or when you're going to lose one. I know, like, I always have an extra whistle in my suitcase too, because I'm like, you just never know.
But, do you have a go-to whistle color?
I like to keep it simple. I always have a black whistle. Okay. When I was younger, I always had a pink whistle, and that was kind of my signature, but I just always use a black one now.
Okay.
And my lanyard is made by my friend Vinay with Lucky Lanyards and Leashes. And my lanyard is turquoise and black. That's kind of my go-to right now.
Cool. Well, thank you so much, Jaylee, for joining me for the episode. How can listeners connect with you or people that are interested in sending you their dog for training?
Yeah. So you can find me on my website. It's greengablegundogs.com. And I'm also have a Facebook page and Instagram page. And you can find that by just searching Green Gable Gundogs as well.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast.
Don't forget, support the conservation organizations and the birds you're chasing after and the public land which you hunt.